We've looked at two arguments for the late date view. A third argument for late date. A third argument revolves around archaeological work on cities in the land of Canaan that are said in the book of Joshua who have been taken by the Israelites at the time of the conquest. And in a number of cases, some of those cities that are mentioned in Joshua as having been taken by Joshua show destruction levels at about 1250 to 1200 BC. For example, in the city of Lachish, you have a destruction level 1200, 1250 BC. If you look at Joshua 10:32, you read there, the Lord handed Lachish over to Israel, and Joshua took it on the second day. The city and everyone in it he put to the sword, just as they had done with Lachish. There is a destruction level at that same time at Bethel. There's one at Hazor. There's one at Debir. Debir, if you look at Joshua 10:38, Joshua and all Israel turned around and attacked Debir. They took the city, its king, its villages, put them to the sword. Everyone in it, they totally destroyed. They left no survivors. They did to Debir and its king as they had done to Libna and its king, the Hebrew. If you look at your citations page 5, paragraph C, this is a paragraph from R.K. Harrison's Introduction to the Old Testament. Harrison says, and of course, as I mentioned earlier, Harrison is one of the late-date advocates. Harrison says, thus, if a clear view of the conquest period is to be obtained, it is important to distinguish between the events that characterized it and those that occurred after the death of Joshua, when a resurgence of native Canaanite population took place. The conquest can be illustrated by the facts of archaeological exploration at sites such as Bethel, Lachish, Debir, Hebron, Gibeah, and Hazor, which show clearly that these places were occupied or destroyed in the latter part of the Late Bronze Age. Now, just for a minute, let me go forward here on your slides. For archaeological periods in Canaan. The Late Bronze Age, you see there in the middle of that diagram, is 1500 to 1200. So, if there are destruction layers in the latter part of the Late Bronze Age, see that's about 1250 to 1200. Notice what Harrison then says in his next sentence. If this destructive activity is to be correlated with the campaigns of Joshua, as outlined in the biblical sources, Joshua 11:16 following, but also in chapter 10. It would appear that the land as a whole was occupied with comparative rapidity by the Israelite invaders, although not all the fortified strongholds, including a belt of Canaanite resistance separating the northern and southern tribes, were reduced at that time. So the argument is there are destruction levels in these cities that are mentioned among the cities taken by Joshua. And those destruction levels, 1250 and 1200, the assumption then is that those destruction levels are to be attributed to the Israelite conquest. Now that is an assumption. What you will read when you read Merrill in the discussion of this, and there are other people who have written similar things, is that if you really read closely in the biblical description of the conquest, There are only three cities that are specifically stated to have been destroyed by the Israelites at the time of the conflict. And those three are Jericho, Ai, or Ai, and Hazor, where it says the cities were burned. Jericho, you know, the walls fell. If you go back, you know this, to say what Joshua 10 says about Lachish, verse 32, the Lord handed Lachish over to Israel, Joshua took it. The city and everyone in it, he put to the sword. It doesn't say he burned the city or destroyed the city. So, you see, the question is, can you equate those destruction levels with the Israelite conquest? And the debate goes on that issue. That's the third argument. So you have first, you have Exodus 1:11, Python Ramses. You have no sedentary population, at least as argued by Nelson Bloor, prior to 1300 in Transjordan. You have destruction levels in certain cities that are mentioned in Joshua that haven't been taken by the Israelites, and the argument is that the late date advocates that those destruction levels are to be attributed to Israel. But see, that's one of the problems of archaeology. You come in there, you find a destruction level. There's no sign that says this was done by the Israelites or this was done by whoever. So there's a certain matter of certain degree of guesswork involved in that. Fourth argument. The argument is the book of Judges. The book of Judges says nothing about the Palestinian expeditions of Sethos the First and Ramses the Second. Now, if we go back there to the 19th dynasty, you see Sethos and Ramses. We know that Sethos and Ramses the Second both conducted military campaigns up in the land of Canaan and even beyond, to the north. In the year 1279, Ramses the Second fought a battle on the Orontes River. That's way up north of current Beirut, up in Syria. Kadesh on the Orontes. He fought there with the Hittites. The Hittite Empire was trying to move to the south. The Egyptians didn't want the Hittites to come down. They took their armies to the north. They had a battle, and it was a standoff. There wasn't really a winner or a loser. And then what they did was sign a non-aggression pact. And we have copies. We have a Hittite copy and an Egyptian copy of that non-aggression pact signed between the Hittites and the Egyptians in the time of Ramses II. So we know Ramses II took an army up through the land of Canaan. If you look at your citations, page 4, paragraph B, this is again from Finnegan's book, Life in the Ancient Past, where he says, the inscriptions of Seti I speak of campaigns in Palestine and Syria, Pekanan, the Canaan, retinue, and Kadesh being among the places mentioned. One description said of his return to Egypt, his majesty arrived from the countries when he had desolated retinue and slain their chiefs, causing he has Asiatics to say, see this, he is like a plane when it goes forth and no water is broke. And then of Ramses II, actually the Asiatics were not as fearful of Egyptian power as Seti I likes to believe, and his successor, Ramses II, had to battle throughout his 67 years of his reign against them, the Asiatics or these Canaanites. Although his only victory in the famous Kadesh on the Orontes battle with the Hittites was that of escaping complete destruction, The personal heroism of Ramesses II was depicted proudly in numerous Egyptian scenes. Now, the way this argument works is this. If Israel went out of Egypt in the 1400s, and you have an early date for the Exodus, that would mean when you come down to this time, in the 1300s and 1200s, where you have Seti and Ramesses going with their armies up and down through the land of Canaan, if you have an early date for the Exodus, you'd be in the time of the Judges. And in the book of Judges, you have reference to Midianite oppression, Ammonite oppression, Philistine oppression, various of these bordering peoples to Israel who were oppressing the Israelites. You have no reference to Egyptian armies going up and through the land of Canaan. So really the argument, you see, is silence of the book of Judges on the campaigns of Seti and Ramesses. Any question on that? You follow that? Now, it's an argument from silence. Arguments from silence are not the strongest argument. That doesn't mean Seti and Ramesses couldn't have been going up through there. It just means that whoever wrote the book of Judges didn't choose to talk about Egyptian activity in the land of Canaan. But that's the argument. Those are really the four arguments. I want to give you a fifth point, however, which sets a terminus date for the late period. The limit for the late date, beyond which I don't think you can go, is determined by an inscription, a stone inscription by Merneptah. See the pharaoh there, 1234 to 1222. In an inscription of Merneptah, in the fifth year of his reign, depending on which of those chronologies you take, normally it's put on, you take the one there on the right, it would be around 1220. He speaks about defeating various peoples and cities in the land of Canaan, and he mentions by name among them Israel. So sometimes this Merneptah inscription is called the Israel inscription. It's the first reference to Israel in any extra biblical source. But what it means is the Israelites must have been in Canaan prior to 1220. And if you take 40 years for wilderness wandering before coming into the land of Canaan, add that on, it would suggest sometime prior to 1260 for the day of the Exodus. 1260, 40 years get you down to 1220. By 1220, Israel was in Canaan, according to Merneptah. Makes reference to it. So, the limit to the late date, as far as how late you can push it, really determined, I think, by that Egyptian inscription that refers to Israel. Any questions? I might just say generally, as first class, I welcome any interaction, discussion. You want to add something, question something, don't hesitate. Let's go to the early date. Viewpoint. We'll go back to the 18th dynasty. I think, if you look at these arguments for the late date, a lot of it's arguments from silence. No sedentary population, no reference to Palestinian expeditions of 79. See, those are arguments from silence. The destruction levels Canaanite cities. It's the assumption that Israel was the agent. So, it's not clear cut. The strongest argument for late date is Exodus 1:11 that mentions Ramesses. We come to the early days. Strongest argument, again, is a biblical statement. It's 1 Kings 6:1. And if you turn to that, this is what it says. In the 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. So, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, he began to build the temple. And that was 480 years after the Exodus. We can date the fourth year of Solomon's reign. When you get into chronological matters in the Old Testament with the kingdom period, there are certain places. Let me back up a minute. In the books of 1st and 2nd Kings, you have what is called a synchronous chronology of the kings of the northern kingdom and the kings of the southern kingdom, Israel and Judah. And if you're familiar enough, I think, with the text to know that the way that reads is, when a certain king in the north began to reign, it was in the fifth year of the reign of some king in the south. And he reigned X number of years in the south. So that the reigns of the northern kings are synchronized with the reigns of the southern kings, and vice versa. When a southern king begins to reign in a certain year of another king in the north, and you work back and forth like that. So it's a synchronous chronology. There are a couple points in the chronology of the kings of Israel and Judah where we can make links into Assyrian chronology. Jehu paid tribute, for example, to Shalmaneser in 840. That's mentioned in the Bible. It's mentioned in Assyrian records. So you can make the connection. And in Assyrian chronological records, they link the reigns of their kings with astronomical data, like eclipses and things of that sort, so that from those kinds of references, you can establish an absolute date for the reigns of the Assyrian kings, and then work from the Assyrian kings into the Israelite chronology and get absolute dates for certain points in the Israelite chronology. And if you have a couple of those points, then you work backwards and forwards to establish the other, because we know how much time each king reigned. So, I mean, this, I've simplified something extremely complex. If you're really interested, get the book by Edwin R. Keeley called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. There's a book-length treatment of the chronology, the synchronous chronology of the book of Kings. And there are a lot of complicated issues there. But he's done a great work on looking at this problem. And most people are pretty well agreed. You can come to a pretty firm date for the dates of the reigns of Israel and kings. There are a few exceptions. But to make a long story short, we know pretty firmly that the fourth year of Solomon was 966-967, because we can work from a later point projected back just by the years of the reigns of other kings. If fourth year of Solomon's reign is 966 or 967, and that is 480 years after the Exodus, what's that tell you? It tells you the Exodus was in 1446. You go back to the 18th dynasty, that's in the time of Amenhotep II. And for a lot of people, that settles the argument. 1 Kings 6:1 says it's 480 years before the time of the fourth year of Solomon's reign, and you have the date of the Exodus, so there's no further discussion. I think the question then arises, what do these late-date advocates do with 1 Kings 6:1? Someone like Dave Kitchen is a very strong advocate of reliability of the Old Testament scripture, so we're going to pay Harrison. Yet they advocate a late date. Well, what do they do with this? There's two different approaches. Generally, people say this 480 years must be some kind of a schematic number. And what has often been suggested is that it's a schematic number for 12 generations of 40 years, taking 40 years as just a kind of an arbitrary number for a generation. And if you take 12 times 40, you come up with 480. Well, you say, where do you get the 12? If you say it's a schematic for the great leaders from Moses to Solomon, you can count it this way. You have Moses and Joshua, that's two. After Joshua, you get six major judges in the book of Judges. That's eight. And after the book of Judges, you get in Samuel, Eli, Samuel, Saul, and David, four more. So you see, as far as major leaders, going from Moses to David, you've got 12. You have Moses, Joshua, six major judges, Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Barak, Gideon, Jephthah, Samson. And then Eli, Samuel, Saul, and David. So say this is those 12 major leaders in that span of history, but that a generation in reality is more like 25 years than 40 years. 12 times 25 is 300. If you take 966 and 300, then you are 1266, and you're back to the late. So that's one way people argue. In other words, they're saying, you know, not to take 480 as 480 actual years, but it's a schematic number for 12 generations. Now, K.A. Kitchen has a different way to deal with 1 Kings 6:1. He speaks of that 480 as what he calls an aggregate number. Now, what he means by that is a bit complex. He says the number is an accurate number, but it's an aggregate of various components, the parts of which we no longer know. But the figure is actual and reliable, but it includes components that overlap, so that in actual years the number can be compressed. Now, let me point you to page 6 of your citations to let him explain that in his own words. And as I said, it's a bit complex, but this is the way he argues it. Look at paragraph C in the middle of page 6. This is from his book, Ancient Orient and Old Testament, and here he's discussing from the Exodus to Solomon. That 1 Kings 6. He says, here the evidence is rather more complicated. The primary evidence and biblical data used so far would indicate an interval of roughly 300 years. See, he's a late date advocate. So he says the primary evidence and biblical data of those late date arguments give us an interval of roughly 300 years from the Exodus to Solomon. For the same interval, 1 Kings 6:1 gives 480 years. While addition of all the individual figures in the books from Exodus to 1 Kings, notice this, gives a total of some 553 years plus three unknown amounts, which we'll hear be called X. In other words, if you look at every chronological statement from Exodus to 1 Kings and add them up, you're going to get 553 plus another unknown amount. Now, a lot of those chronological statements occur in the book of Judges. You know, a judge arises, delivers Israel from oppression. They were oppressed for 20 years, and then they rest for 40 years, and then they oppressed again and rest. And you get all these 20-year, 40-year, 20-year numbers. And the question is, were all these times of oppression and rest sequential, all one after the other, or were they more regional and some of them overlapping? Now, I'll just make this comment at this point, and that's why I say this gets very complex. It doesn't matter whether you are an early data advocate or a late data advocate, you are going to be forced to conclude that there's some overlap in the chronology of the book. We'll come back to that later when we get to it. But a late date is going to have to compress those numbers a lot more than an early date. But you're going to have to deal with that. You've got 553 years plus some unknown amounts. Pick up where it goes further. Furthermore, David's genealogy of five generations in Ruth 4 can hardly easily extend over the 260 years or so between him and the Exodus, and so it is probably a selective one. Well, that's a general rule of biblical genealogies, that they're compressed. But that of the priest Zadok, 1 Chronicles 6, of 10 generations, would about cover the 300 years, given a 30 years for a generation. The genealogies need be no problem. That's not an issue. But what shall we make of the 480, 1 Kings 6:1, and the 553 plus X? You add up all the chronological data in the intervening period, as compared with the roughly 300 years interval required by our primary evidence. Now, his primary evidence is going back to Exodus 1:11, Python Ramesses, destruction levels of Canaanite cities, etc. Here's his comment. In principle, this problem is not quite so contradictory as it may appear. If we remember that the Old Testament is also part of the ancient Near East, and therefore that ancient Oriental principles must be applied. Thus, in ordinary king lists and historical narratives, ancient scribes and writers did not usually include synchronistic tables and cross-references as we do today. Synchronisms were the subject of special and separate historiographic works. In biblical terms, Judges, as a narrative with a historico-religious purpose, does not deal with synchronism, except with oppressors as part of its story. While Kings is a synchronous history of Israel and Judah, while also a selective religious record, in some degree comparable with the so-called synchronous histories of Assyria and Babylonia. Here, an Egyptian example will be instructive as a parallel prophet. And here's really the way he argues that the biblical chronological issue is after an analogy with this Egyptian chronological record. For the five dynasties, 13 to 70, the so-called second intermediate period of Egyptian history, the Turin Papyrus of Kings records, or did when it was complete, some 170 kings who reigned at least 520 years altogether. Now, we also know they all belong inside the period 1786 to 1550, a maximum period of only about 240 years at most. So here's these 170 kings. If you add up the lengths of the reigns of each king, you get 520, but they all have to be fit into 240 years. A hopeless contradiction, he says? No. We know, too, that these dynasties were all partly contemporary. The 520 or so years are genuine enough. but were partly concurrent, not all consecutive. This may prove equally true of some of the judges in early Israel. You see, that's what I referred to a minute ago. So that the 553 plus X years would then fit into the roughly 300 years, just like the 520 or so into the roughly 240 in Egypt. Now, and here's where he makes the move back to 1 Kings 6:1. Now, in the ancient Orient, chroniclers and other writers often use excerpts from fuller records. And this might explain the 480 years. What is the 480 years? A total of selected figures, details now unknown, taken from a larger total. In other words, something like that 520 years in Egypt that we know from other details was actually 240 years. Maybe the 480 is a similar kind of aggregate number like that 520 is. We don't know what the details of the aggregate are composed of, details now unknown, taken from the large total. The various figures are therefore not so refractory in principle when relevant principles are applied. To work this out in practice within the book of Judges is not easy, simply because we need more detailed information on the period than is available there or from elsewhere. But neither is it beyond possibility, as is evident from an unpublished preliminary study. The problem with the book of Judges is chronologically rather less complicated than other celebrated problems of Near Eastern chronology, such as the second intermediate period in Egypt, the David Hammurabi of Babylon, where a similar situation occurred. So, what do late date advocates do with this 480 years that early date advocates say really settles the issue? 1446, 966 plus 1446. Well, late-day people come back and say, not so quick, that 480 may be schematic number for 12 generations, or it may be some kitchen's case, some kind of aggregate number taken out of whatever sources were available to the writer of Kings, not explaining what the aggregate was made up of, but less than 480 years in actual years. May I follow your argument? Any question? Yeah. Although, as I mentioned, with judges, you cannot simply take all the chronological data because it doesn't fit the Hebrew data. But it has to be liberal. The question is how much? Yeah. I'd say yes and no. I don't think, again, you get into this historical through theological through virtue. I don't think the theology of book of Exodus is affected by whether the Exodus occurred in 18 times or 19 times. Yeah. Doesn't really matter. But this question of historical background for the books of the Bible and historical reliability of the books of the Bible is certainly an important issue. And any information we can get that throws light on the historical context for the Exodus is helpful and lives today in the background of the Exodus. So, yeah.
This seems to be a bad argument.
That's. I think you're right. And I think that's a mistaken way to go about this. In fact, I have something I was going to say at the end of this discussion. That, you know, is this taking a view and then like a lawyer trying to build the case? Or should we come to this with the attitude, let's try to find out whatever information there is that throws light on the biblical material? That goes better. But this debate gets very heated, you know, so which I don't share that as being probably where the book is. Let's go on to the second argument. For early date now, second argument. In the 18th dynasty, Thutmose III, you see on the screen there, 1504 or 1501, depending on the chronology, he was a great builder with a long lifespan. See, he has a, 46-year rule. That's a long word. He was a great builder with a long lifespan. If he was the king of the oppression, then the Exodus would have occurred under his successor, Amenhotep II. Now, as I mentioned earlier, until recently, there was no evidence that 18th dynasty pharaohs had built up there in the Delta. If you look at page 5 of your citations, paragraph B, this is taken from R.K. Harrison, who was a late-date advocate. He says the tradition preserved in Exodus that government store cities were erected by the use of forced Israelite labor has been largely confirmed independently by excavations in Egypt. An ancient site in the Wadi Tumila, Tel El Retaba, supposed to have been Ramses by Petrie, who excavated originally, is now known to have been Python. Work at the site has uncovered some of the massive brickwork erected by Ramses II. Then notice this next page. And since no traces of 18th dynasty construction expansion were evident, it would appear the Exodus tradition forced labor referred to the time of Ramses II. Now, as I mentioned, Harrison couldn't say that for David, because in the last 10 years, evidence of 18th dynasty construction has been found up there in Delta. I think the problem for early date advocates is how could that site, either Kantir or Avaris, which one of those two is presumably what's called Ramesses in Exodus 111, how could one of those sites been called Ramesses two or three centuries before the time of the pharaohs known by the name of Ramesses? In other words, you're back up here in the 18th dynasty, there's no Ramesses around. Now, there are two responses by early date people to the question of how the Israelites could have been working on Ramesses long before the time of Ramesses. Gleason Archer, who is an early date advocate, argues that the name Ramesses was known and used earlier than the time of the 19th dynasty. There are many pharaohs mentioned by that name, but he has found evidence of the use of the name in the 18th dynasty. If you look on your citations, the first page, there's that second entry under Archer, an 18th dynasty Ramesses, published in Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society back in 1974. I'm not going to take the time to read through those two paragraphs, but he gives evidence of the use of that name Ramesses in the 18th dynasty. If you go over to page 2, the last three lines, he says the name Ramesses, in its non-Geminate form at least, was already known and used in noble circles during the reign of Amenhotep III, if not before. It would therefore have been no surprise for a 15th century Moses to have been well acquainted with. So that's one argument. That name was known and used earlier. I think that that's still, you wonder, why would the city be called Ramesses if the pharaohs by that name didn't occur in the 19th dynasty? But the other argument is that the name is simply the modernization of an archaic place name. In other words, at the time the Israelites worked on that city, what it was Ramses. The Ramses name became attached to that city late. It would be much like saying the Dutch were the original settlers of New York City. If you say, for some people don't know much about American history, the Dutch were the settlers of New Amsterdam, they might not know what you're talking about. Then you say New York City, well, at the time the Dutch were there, it wasn't New York City, it was New Amsterdam. So that'd be a modernization of an archaic place name, kind of falling out of use. Now, you say, well, that's kind of arbitrary. I don't think it is, because it's really the same thing that happens in Genesis 14:14. Look at Genesis 14:14. This is where Abraham was rescuing Lot. And you read... chapter 15. When Abraham heard that his relative, that's Lot, had been taken captive, he called out the 318 men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now compare Genesis 14:14 with Judges 18:7 and 18:29. In Judges 18, you have the story about the tribe of Dan sending some of their people to the north in the land of Canaan to look for another place to live. And they found this place, and they eventually migrated from the land originally assigned to them in the time of Joshua to the north. And you read in 18:7, the five men left came to Laish, where they saw that the people were living in safety like the Sidonians, unsuspecting and secure. Since their land liked nothing, they were prosperous. And then you go down to verse 29, and you read, the Danites rebuilt the city, settled there. They named it Dan, after their forefather Dan, who was born to Israel, though the city used to be called Laish. There the Danites set up for themselves the idols, and Jonathan, son of Gershon, son of Moses, son of priests, and so forth. But you go back to Genesis 14, and it says that Abraham and his servants pursued, doesn't say the Laish, says the Dan. In the time of Abraham, that place was called Laish. It wasn't called Dan. It didn't take the name Dan until the time of the period of the Judges. So it seems quite evident in Genesis 14 what you have is the modernization of an archaic place name. Now if you have that in Genesis 14, why couldn't you have it in Exodus 1:11, where the city may have been called Kantir when the Israelites worked on it, and later it came to be known as Ramses. So that when people no longer remember the archaic place name for the site, they could read this and they know what you're talking about. Look at your citations, page 8 on that. Middle of the page. This is from Merrill Unger's Archaeology in the Old Testament. Archaeology has located Python, Tel El, Retaba, and Ramses of Tanis, and indicated that these cities were built by Ramses II. But, in the light of Ramses II's notorious practice of taking credit for achievements accomplished by his predecessors, these sites were most certainly merely rebuilt or enlarged by him. Moreover, since it is true that Tanis was called Per Ramesses, the House of Ramesses, for only a couple of centuries, The reference in 111 must be to the older city, Zone of Aris, where the oppressed Israelites labored centuries earlier. Accordingly, the name Ramses be construed as the modernization of an archaic place name like Dan for Lach in Genesis 14:14. So, get back to this argument. Second argument. In the 18th dynasty, Thutmose III was a great builder. There is evidence of 18th dynasty construction in the Delta area, but he was a great builder with a long lifespan. And that latter consideration is also important, the long lifespan. I think Moses' lifespan creates a very difficult problem for late-date advocates. The late-date advocates, Seti, who would be the pharaoh of the repression, didn't have a long lifespan. If you go to the chronological data of Exodus, you find Moses is born at the time of the oppression in 2:1. A man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And that's Moses. Deuteronomy 34:7 says that Moses was 120 years old when he died. Deuteronomy 34:7. Moses was 120 years old when he died. Yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. Go back to Exodus. In Exodus 7, verse 7, you read, Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. If you go to Acts chapter 7, where there is reference to this time of Moses, you get some more chronological information. Acts 7:23, you read, when Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his fellow Israelites. He saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. That was when he was 40 years old, and that was when he was forced to flee into the wilderness. But then you go down to verse 29. When Moses heard this, he fled to Midian, where he settled as a foreigner, had two sons. And verse 30, after 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to Moses in the flames of a burning bush in the desert near Mount Sinai. And the Lord spoke to him and told him, notice down verse 34, to go back to Egypt and deliver the people from Israelite oppression. So Moses lived 120 years. He was 40 years old when he went into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness 40 years. He came back after 40 years. He would have been 80. And he was 80 when he confronted Pharaoh and asked for Israel's release, and then he gave 40 more years. So, those chronological numbers about the lifespan of Moses fit with Thutmose as the Pharaoh of the oppression, but they don't fit with the lifespan of Seti. There's just not enough time there. If you go back to page one of your citations, again, Gleason Archer, but the first paragraph there from his survey of Old Testament introduction, Archer says, no other known pharaoh fulfills all the specifications besides Thutmose III. He alone, besides Ramesses II, was on the throne long enough, 54 years, including the 21 years of Hatshepsut's regency, who had been reigning at the time of Moses' flight from Egypt, and to pass away not long before Moses called by the burning bush 30 or 40 years later. So, the lifespan of Moses fits better, I might say, with the length of the reign of Thutmose than it would with the 1940s. The question.
Can he question
the previous Thutmose? Yeah, oh. Yeah, the problem is Moses didn't return until the first pharaoh died. See, he returned. Well, yeah, I guess you could argue that it would have been. Let's see. In Exodus, let's find where it says that. It says in chapter. Verse 23. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery, cried out. God heard their groaning, remembered his covenant, and then he appears to Moses in the burning bush. Tells him to go back. So it seems like that Pharaoh the oppression dies. God then speaks to Moses. Says, go back, and he confronts who he is. Next Pharaoh, who is the Pharaoh of the Exodus, as distinguished from the Pharaoh of the oppression. Now, how long did that take? You know, the negotiation by the first. Literally not that long. But, as I said, this complex problem, I think it's easier to fit the lifespan of Moses with Thutmose as an oppressor. And here's where. The 19th dynasty, then it said it was the 19th. But then you have to sit on the ground and continue the oppression and what is the great kings were. All right, let's go to one more argument for early years. There are a couple more, but I think we can do one more. Third argument for early date is based on some references in what are called the Amarna letters to a people who are called Habiru, and those Habiru were people who were attacking Canaanite cities. And some of the early date advocates have said these references in the Amarna letters to Habiru attacking Canaanite cities are really a reference to the Hebrews attacking Canaanite cities, and the Habiru are Hebrews, and what is in view there in these references is the Israelite conquest of Canaan. Now, let's talk about that a bit. In the time of Amenhotep III, you see him down there in 1410 to 1377. Egypt lost its hold upon Palestine. And by the time of Amenhotep IV, who also went by another name, Ikhnaton, we have these things called the Amarna letters. So you're in the time of Amenhotep IV. And the Amarna letters are letters from city-state rulers in Canaan to the Egyptian pharaoh. If you look at your citations pages 2 and 3, there's some material there from Finnegan's Light from the Ancient Past about the Amarna letters. And you notice in the third line, they represent correspondence from vassal princes and governors in Syria and Palestine with Amenhotep III and with Akhenaten, who is Amenhotep IV. I'm not going to take time to read all of that, but if you go over to page 3, top of the page, you read in Jerusalem, Abdi-Heba was governor. He wrote repeatedly to Akhenaten, or Amenhotep IV, asking for Egyptian troops and stating that unless they were sent, the entire country would be lost to Egypt. And what follows in those indented lines are quotations from some of the Amarna letters. If you go down a little bit below the middle of the page, you will see in one of his letters, Abdi-Heba of Jerusalem says, "Why do you love the Habiru?" See, there's that name. "And hate the regents. But therefore am I slandered before the king my lord, because I say the lands of the king my lord are lost." That's the Egyptian pharaoh. "Therefore am I slandered to the king my lord, so let the king the lord care for his land. Let the king turn his attention to the archers, so the archers of the king my lord will go forth. No lands of the king remain. The Habiru plunder all lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king my lord will remain. But if archers are not here, the lands of the king my lord are lost." So what he's doing is appealing to Amenhotep IV to send help, or these Habiru are going to take over Jerusalem. And some have felt that here is an ex-biblical reference to the Hebrews, Habiru of Hebrews. That might seem pretty attractive. I mean, look at the dates. Amenhotep IV, if the Exodus was 1446, Amenhotep IV, 1380, pretty close. 40 years in the wilderness. However, identification of Hebrew with Habiru is far from certain. The word is used of people scattered from Asia Minor, that is present-day Turkey, to Egypt, all the way over into Mesopotamia. And if you look at all the references, and there have been books written on this subject, of who are the Habiru, it seems like the word designates a social class rather than an ethnic group. The Habiru seem to have been semi-nomads. They've wandered around at various times, settled down into more sedentary living, but they were wanderers. If you look at page 6, paragraph B, this is from Kitchen. Of course, Kitchen's a late-date advocate. He doesn't want to identify Habiru with Hebrew. It doesn't fit his late-date view. But here's his comment. "The Amarna Habiru have no direct bearing on the date of the Exodus or conquest, except indirectly to precede them, and so cannot support a date for these events in 15th and 14th centuries BC, as was once held. As has been said long ago," and I think this is a good statement, I think Kitchen can substantiate it. "As has been said long ago, the Hebrews may have been Habiru." In other words, they were wanderers, 40 years in the wilderness. People may have referred to them as Habiru. The Hebrews may have been Habiru. "But not all Habiru are biblical Hebrews." That's clear. "Nor can any particular group in the external data be yet identified as corresponding to the Hebrews." So it seems to me you have to be very careful about the equation. The Habiru of the Amarna letters are the Hebrews, even though that's an argument that's often used for the early days. As I mentioned, the words used of people from Asia Minor to Egypt, from Mesopotamia, from the 18th century to the 12th century. And there are references to Hivi ruling Egypt as late as the time of Ramesses IV, way down there in the 1100s. So either they're not identified with Hebrews, or all the Hebrews didn't leave Egypt at the time of the Exodus. So I think you have to be very careful about that third argument. The Hivi ruling Amoraim letters are Hebrews, and therefore you equate that and say the Exodus was early because of that identification. Question or comment? All right, we'll stop at this point and pick up here a couple more arguments on this early days. We'll pick up the beginning of the next hour and then get on to something else.